Judiciary Committee to order. We do have a quorum, including myself, Senator McGuire, my vice chairman, Senator John Coghill, and Senator Mia Costello. And we're awaiting Senator Bill Lukowski. So we're going to take up just one bill today, as you know, both today and Friday, so that we can move this bill out by Friday. And the bill is Senate Bill 30, and it's the marijuana decriminalization bill. And so just by way of explanation to all of you here in the room, we've been working on the bill, as you know, for a matter of a couple of weeks. We made a big substantive change from the beginning, moving from, I guess you'd sort of say, a Napoleonic way to an Anglo-Saxon way, right, of dealing with the matter of decriminalization, which has made the initiative sponsors happy. It's made the public happy, and it's made the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee and the House Judiciary Committee happy, but it's made a bigger bill, and so that's taken a lot more time, and we've been working our way through it. The net effect has been that it has taken marijuana out of the controlled substance statutes of Alaska statutes, and treated it more like alcohol. So should this bill pass, marijuana will be treated as a regulated substance under Alaska state law. There will still be penalties for using marijuana in certain circumstances, even if you're 21, depending on it being more than 1 ounce, depending on it being in public places, depending on it being while using a vehicle or heavy equipment, depending on it being in a workplace where it's prohibited, depending on being a minor. All those kinds of things are addressed in this bill in various places. So I wanted to make it clear on the record that this bill is not a wholesale change to say that somehow in Alaska we just say use marijuana wherever you want, whenever you want, etc. It's not that at all. But what we've attempted to do is strike a balance in adopting, the most important thing is to implement the voters' will in an initiative, which at its root said, we no longer want to criminalize the basic act of a 21-year-old Alaskan adult who possesses an ounce of marijuana to be subject to a criminal sanction. And so that's what we've attempted to do. And that's what this bill is. We're narrowed down now to just a few basic areas of discussion. They're not huge, but they are those final places. So between today's hearing and Friday's hearing, it's our intent to resolve them as best we can so this bill can move to the Senate Finance Committee. The bill itself is on track to pass by the end of this month. I don't know if we'll meet the 24th deadline, and that's okay, because on the 24th, the initiative goes into effect, and the initiative will make it clear that an adult cannot be arrested for possessing an ounce of marijuana, 21 and older, but it will be better once this bill passes, of course, and it will be even better yet a year from now when the licensing board comes up with all the regulations that then support the activity, the commercial activity of marijuana. So we know that years from now we'll have a better licensing structure in place. And I kind of think about a little bit like prohibition, what it might have been like in those days, that if you had that first step of saying, okay, we're going from the underground activity of alcohol being a bootlegged kind of item to bringing it above board, and then there's stages going with it. So with that, I'm going to let all of you know how we're going to go through the hearing today. So the first area where we still have some disagreement is over the use of the phrase, quote, notwithstanding any other provision of the law. And we're really in Nerdville right now, right? I mean, sorry, we're in the Judiciary Committee, so if you were hoping for a more exciting committee, you might want to pick up and, I don't know, go to the HESS committee or something, but this is really where we're at. So we're going to hear from Jeff Pickett, who again is the attorney for the Judiciary Committee. He's going to give you an overview of why you should also care about the phrase notwithstanding any other provision of the law if you didn't before. And then we're going to hear from Rachel Young, who's going to be introduced by Tom Hindenberger, who's one of the Alaska gentlemen that sponsored the initiative. And so he's going to introduce Rachel Young because she is with the Marijuana Policy Project outside, and they care very much about this phrase. Our drafters care very much and don't want it in, and they care very much that they want it in. So you're going to hear their opinions. Bruce Schulte, who's also an Alaskan, he is going to give his opinion, and then Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal, she'll give her opinion. Okay, so that's issue number one. Issue number two is the gentleman to my left, Senator Coghill. This is about delinquent minors. You've heard us touch on this issue briefly. We're going to have Doug Wolliver, who's here in the audience with the Alaska court system, talk to us a little bit about how we deal with the subject of publicizing offenses that are minor offenses, generally, and what the options could be for us here. You're going to hear Tracy Wallenberg's opinion from the Public Defender Agency. You're going to hear from Major Dennis Casanovas with the Alaska State Troopers. And then you're going to hear from Matt Davidson. He's the Acting Social Services Program Officer with Juvenile Justice, his opinion. And then Senator Coghill is going to propose a draft of what Amendment Number 1 would look like for us to consider loosely today, what the idea would be, and his thoughts about that. And basically the idea, again, is whether we want to make this a violation, and if we do we want it to be a violation that goes on court view or not? Or do we want to make it a misdemeanor? If it's a misdemeanor, the youth goes before a judge and has some interaction with a judge, which could be subject to diversion and treatment, and would not go on court view because they would go into the minor, the juvenile system, but it would be, in fact, a misdemeanor. So there are some things to consider. Finally, there are two other categories. Number three is that the Department of Health and Social Services and Jay Butler has asked to present what he believes would be fiscal impacts of this bill. They're the only agency that has said there will be. And so we've said we'd like you to come forward before it goes to the Finance Committee. And another person on that subject is Diane Casto with the Prevention and Early Intervention. She's the Prevention and Early Intervention Manager with the Division of Behavioral Health. She'd like to speak. And Matt Davidson, who's the Acting Social Services Program Director with the Division of Juvenile Justice. And then finally, the last topic will also be Senator Coghill. And this is relating to the definition of public. And that's a proposed amendment, Amendment Number 2. Tracy Wallenberg would like to speak on that from the Public Defender Agency. Again, we want to have Rachel Young with the Director of State Policies for the Marijuana Policy Project, Bruce Schulte, and Hillary Martin. I have on here a note from Amy that says if we have time, we'll talk about the issue of concentrates and the issue of 1 ounce, time permitting. If not, it'll come up on Friday as our final issue there. I'll note that Senator Costello has one other subject that she wants incorporated into a committee substitute. And do you want to just say what that is on the record? Because it's being incorporated.
Certainly. Thank you. Through the chair. So in the portion of the legislation that talks about a campaign in which we talk about the effects of marijuana use, I thought it would be important to also at the same time include a component of education of what this law actually does in the initiative, just so that we're educating Alaskans about the law so there's not confusion about it for those people who haven't been following as closely as others. So thank you for that.
Okay, so without further ado, Doug Wolliver. Jeff Pickett. And Jeff, you're online, so if you could just give us the overview on notwithstanding any other provision of the law.
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. Again, my name is Jeff Pickett, and I'm an attorney, and I've been asked to to kind of give an overview on this phrase, notwithstanding any other provision of law, and I think the members of the committee probably have my notes. I prepared some notes that folks could use to follow along with, but I'm going to go through them as well right now, just in case some people listening in or in the committee room itself don't have those notes.
And Jeff, just not to interrupt you, but just to point that members have the memo from you to Senate Judiciary Committee members dated February the 18th, but if you just go through it so it's on the record.
Yes, very good, Madam Chair. We'll do. The phrase appeared 7 times in the initiative itself, and then it was removed in the various versions of Senate Bill 30 that have appeared over the last couple weeks. And whether to include that phrase is now an issue or has been an issue, and a variety of different arguments on either side of that question. And my job is not to take a side, but other people testifying will be. But here basically is sort of how it is used often when it does appear in statutes. Kind of the bigger picture, courts refer to the phrase as a term of art that's designed to basically either implicitly repeal or amend any other consistent law. So kind of conceptually, it's a catch-all or something that exists, that expresses the legislative intent for whatever it is that's following the notwithstanding phrase, that it have primacy. It's important to note that the phrase cannot bind a future legislature. This did come up from repealing the phrase itself, but subsequent legislation could be still interpreted as being abrogated by the earlier notwithstanding legislation if it's in direct conflict and if there is no direct or explicit repeal. But there's nothing that would prevent a subsequent legislature from just repealing that notwithstanding language. Drafters disfavor it. And I think we'll hear more about that. There are unintended consequences. It's kind of, I think in a lot of drafters' view, it's sort of using a large weapon to win a smaller, precise precision weapon might be a better route. But it does appear often enough in a variety of different legislation contexts, particularly actually kind of interestingly in trade law. So courts will acknowledge the breadth of the literal meaning, and they will enforce that, give the construed the phrase with its literal meaning at times. Our Supreme Court has expressed a construction of the notwithstanding phrase by giving it a quote plain meaning in one case. So that is a possibility. It's definitely a possibility. The courts also are willing, and our Supreme Court has done this as well, to give that very broad phrase a much more narrow construction. And basically what the court will do is they'll kind of scratch their head a little bit, the judges will, and say, well, did the legislature really intend this notwithstanding provision to preempt all these other potential conflicting matters of legislation or areas of law? And if the legislative history or statutory construction doesn't support that broad kind of reading, then they'll more narrowly construe it. And we have a good example of that having happened in a case in 2001 up here called FDIC versus Laidlaw Transit. If anybody wants case citations, I can certainly provide those. The other thing to note is even with the notwithstanding language in a provision of law, courts will still try to harmonize what are on the surface conflicting provisions of law. So even if there is a notwithstanding phrase and there is an apparent conflict with a different piece of legislation, if there's a way to harmonize those two apparently conflicting provisions in the statute, the court can do that, notwithstanding the notwithstanding phrase. So basically, my understanding or sense of the code, in other words, from the point of view of folks advocating for the inclusion of the notwithstanding phrase, the arguments are, I'm sure people will be going into far more detail than this, but basically just a quick laundry list that reflects the language that the voters actually voted for because it appears in the initiative. It will basically trump all laws of conflict, civil, regulatory, and local, not just, at least arguably, not just state statutes. Because this bill has been under a real time crunch, and because the marijuana statutes, or the prohibition against use of marijuana, at least in terms of statutes, has been there for so long, it may not be possible to go out and comb through all of our statutes and find every place where the intent of the initiative sponsors, as well as the Senate and House, when you vote, to go out and find all the places where the intent would have been to preempt the existing law. So, in other words, this is kind of a belt and suspenders phrase. It's also, there is precedent for the use of the phrase in Alaska, and it's also been used, as I understand it, in Colorado's marijuana law. On the other side of the argument, I think it's, as I mentioned earlier, not considered effective drafting by legislative drafters. It can be overbroad. It could be used by a court to interpret SB 30 as trumping laws, existing laws that nobody intended it to abrogate. One of the interesting cases out there, the Supreme Court has said that notwithstanding any other provision of law, phrase can be used to abrogate common law principles as well. And so, it really does have a fairly broad impact. So, for instance, one thing that's worthwhile thinking through is a case so somebody wanting to bring a civil claim for nuisance because their neighbor's smoking a bunch of marijuana and it's drifting over into their backyard and it's causing problems for their children's asthma or whatever. If that notwithstanding any other provision of law is out there, even common law principles like tort claims for nuisance could conceivably be preempted. That's something for the courts to figure out, and I assume Bruce and others will have a response to that, but that is just something to keep in mind. And with that, I think I'll just end it. Happy to answer questions or just move on to the other people testifying.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Any questions? Yes, Senator Costello.
Thank you, through the chair. So you mentioned in your memo that Colorado has used the phrase in their legislation, in their law. So have we seen any cases come before the court in Colorado where this has become an issue because it's actually in their law?
Senator Costello, through the chair, that's a great question. I did not encounter or find a case out of Colorado interpreting that phrase. That doesn't mean there's not one out there, but I didn't find one. So I'm not sure how if it's been applied or construed.
Madam Chair.
I'd certainly be willing to get back to you on. I could do some additional searches this afternoon if you'd like.
Senator Conco.
Thank you, Jeff. Just for what it's worth, they amended their constitution, and so if that's in their constitution, it would be interesting to see how they might interpret that. So if there's any other provisions in their constitution, it would be interesting to see, but this might present a different problem, so just for what it's worth.
Okay.
Senator fire control, and I will go ahead and take a look at the Colorado law, the Constitution, and maybe do a quick follow-up memo for members.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you so much, Jeff. We appreciate it. Excellent. Okay, next, we are going to go to Tim Hintenberger. My apologies, who's going to introduce Rachel Young.
Hello, Chair McGuire. Can you hear me?
I can.
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify again concerning this important measure. And I especially appreciate your earlier comments drawing the parallel between the issue before us at the moment and the repeal of alcohol prohibition many decades ago. That is a parallel that we have been trying to draw from the beginning of our efforts, and you're exactly right that it applies in very many ways, including the fact that we can continue to make adjustments to the regulation of marijuana as time goes on. We're grateful for the legislature's work to revise the criminal code to conform to Measure 2, and we appreciate the committee's and legislative staff's desire to respect the will of the people and for your responsiveness to our recommendations. In particular, we would like to thank you for restoring Section 17.38.020 as approved by the voters, extending the same legal protections that registered marijuana establishments receive to the establishment's employees, and amending the definition of marijuana concentrates to be more comprehensive as specified in the initiative. So as a whole, the latest draft is a bill that we can support. That said, we do still have a few remaining revisions that we recommend, which will be explained in, which are detailed in a memo that I hope you have in front of you, and that Ms. Young from the Marijuana Policy Project will now speak to in more detail.
Okay, Ms. Young, go ahead. My apologies.
No, good afternoon, Chairwoman McGuire and members of the committee. Shall I go ahead with my testimony?
Yes, please just put your name on the record.
Absolutely. My name is Rachelle Young, R-A-C-H-E-L-L-E, last name Young, Y-E-U-N-G, and I'm a legislative analyst for the Marijuana Policy Project. As Dr. Hintenberger mentioned, you have a memo that includes a number of our remaining concerns and suggestions. However, for the sake of time, I will focus solely on the notwithstanding issue this afternoon. So to begin, the notwithstanding language is at the very heart of this initiative. Measure 2 was enacted to ensure that all adults over 21, and specifically those working at licensed marijuana businesses, would not be penalized for certain marijuana-related activities. Measure 2 also ensures that such people's conduct is lawful under state law and immune from seizure and active forfeiture. Removing this voter-enacted phrase would violate voters' intent. This crucial phrase ensures that the initiative's voter-enacted legal protections do trump all the other state statutes and local ordinances that may be contrary to them. This includes not only the state's criminal laws related to marijuana, which this committee is wisely looking at amending, but also state civil laws and local ordinances. Neither the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol, nor this legislature and its staff have the time or capacity to be absolutely completely certain that each and every law that could be interpreted in a way contrary to Measure 2 is indeed being amended. We already know that SB 30 has been an extensive process to draft, and again, you know, we can never be 100% sure. Indeed, early drafts of SB 30 removed or severely limited legal protections for behavior that was legalized under Measure 2. For example, striking legal protections and replacing them with a mere defense, prohibiting the mere display of permissible amounts of marijuana in public, reducing the amount of marijuana that adults could possess on the premises where their personal plants were grown, We understand now that the current bill draft has addressed these issues and that those particular concerns are no longer relevant. However, this illustrates the very real odds that not all statutes that are inconsistent with Measure 2 will be immediately identified and amended to become consistent. Furthermore, even laws that do not explicitly refer to marijuana may put an adult or business engaging in lawful marijuana-related behaviors at legal risk. Absent the notwithstanding clause, laws that refer to, quote, illegal or, quote, illicit activity may be interpreted by courts as applying to activities that were made lawful by Alaska voters under Measure 2, but that remain illegal under federal law. For example, and Mr. Pickett, the attorney right before me, addressed this particular section already. For example, under Measure 2, lawfully registered corporations or marijuana establishments are allowed to engage in the possession, cultivation, processing, etc. of marijuana, but such actions may be interpreted as illegal under statutes requiring the liquidation of assets and businesses of a corporation that acts illegally. The notwithstanding language of Measure 2 would make clear that in such instances, those statutes do not apply to persons or corporations engaging in lawful marijuana-related activities. Absent that language, a judge could rule in that specific situation that the marijuana business's activities violated AS 1020-360, which was the statute we mentioned, because marijuana remains an illegal controlled substance under federal law. This, as an example, was the first statute that the campaign identified as potentially problematic, and we're certain that if we've made a more thorough review of remaining statutes, we would probably find other examples such as that. In addition to concerns about existing laws that may be counter to 1738.020 and 1738.070, in which the notwithstanding language appears in the initiative, laws that may be drafted in the future may also unintentionally contradict the legal protections of Measure 2. Preserving the notwithstanding language would ensure that such laws, future or present, do not penalize acts by adults that voters intended to be lawful. We recognize that the legislature will have the legal authority in 2 years to make any revisions it wishes to Measure 2. However, we hope that it will continue to be guided by the will of voters. The notwithstanding phrase will prevent inadvertent revisions and ensure that Measure 2 and voters' intent is readily apparent when the legislature considers future marijuana-related legislation. Finally, this language, as Mr. Pickett has also indicated, has been used many times throughout Alaska statutes, and we believe that for that reason, that phrase should remain under Measure 2's language. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Young. Any questions from members of the committee? Okay, not seeing any. Okay, next we'll go to Bruce Schulte and then to Hillary Martin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for the time. My name is Bruce Schulte. I'm with the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation. I appreciate your taking the time to hear my comments. We support and agree with those comments that we just heard from the Marijuana Policy Project. And I'd just like to echo the sentiment that we greatly appreciate the evolution that this bill has undergone, and I think that we're now looking at a bill that our group can support as well. In particular, I just wanted to acknowledge the inclusion of a refinement of the definition of public consumption that, while it still makes public consumption unlawful, allows for an opportunity for licensed events in businesses to have limited consumption on premises, so we appreciate that addition. There's only one other comment I would like to offer, and I kind of noticed this with the late in the game, so I'll follow up with this in writing if you wish. We totally support the effort to discourage use of butane in what's called an open blast scenario, because we agree that that's a very hazardous activity and should be discouraged. And so we appreciate the fact that that is codified in Section 200. One thing I noticed, though, this section makes a first degree misdemeanor, a first degree offense, to use volatile explosive gases both for an individual and for a registered business. And I'm not sure that that was intentional, but I would especially suggest that reference be removed or applies to a business, because that's exactly where we do want those kinds of things to take place, in a controlled environment, in an industrial setting, using appropriate equipment and trained personnel. So that could be looked at. I was an architect for about 20 years, so I've actually designed facilities like this, and I know that the International Building Code and fire codes and related codes and statutes, they address this kind of facility very, very clearly, and there's provisions for handling all sorts of potentially hazardous materials. So I would respectfully suggest that last section, 1738-200, paragraph B, subsection 5, be removed. Other than that, I think this is something that we can get behind. I appreciate all the effort, and I'll take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Bruce, any questions for Mr. Schulte? Yes, Senator Klotko.
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce. And I probably will disagree with you on the notwithstanding language, but I'll be pondering that. But one of the questions that just trouble me, and you can help me with it, is we have, under the definition of marijuana, and you've heard me say this before, we have now got concentrates at the same level of marijuana, and I'm struggling on how to, get value statements on that. So the notwithstanding language says, if it could be an ounce of leaves or an ounce of oil, which would be a concentrate, which have huge impact differences. And so, the notwithstanding language starts troubling me because of that. But if I could get to the definition issue, I think I would probably be a whole lot less inclined to just push that, because I think we have to be a little more clear on that definition. Have you given that any more thought?
To the chair, Senator Fossil, thank you for the question. Yes, I have given a considerable thought. I think it's an important question. I guess my perspective on this, since it was articulated the way it was in the ballot initiative, I'm inclined to want to see it treated the same, the concentrates and flour and so forth treated without distinction in this bill. However, I think perhaps, I respect your concern, perhaps it would be more appropriate to address some sort of limits or requirements at the retail level, so that we can get, so we can perhaps minimize how much a person can purchase at a single time. One of my concerns is that, with regard to concentrates, the consumer base is moving in that direction, particularly medical users. And my concern is if we overly regulate or if we make criminal too much of those kinds of products that might be produced in the home or used by medical users, I just think that there might be some unintended consequences there. If it's handled on the retail side in some suitable fashion, I think that would get at the concern without violating the intent of the initiative. The best analogy that I could use would be, alcohol, of course, where you can buy 5% beer or 80 proof alcohol. There's no distinction made on those two products in the store, and so I would respectfully suggest that there's no distinction made between those in the law. So I would respectfully suggest that we handle marijuana the same way. I know it's not probably the answer you're looking for, but it's the best I can offer right now.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, and we're trying to figure out how to give honest-to-goodness penalties that are equivalent to what was expected under the initiative. But an ounce of marijuana generally had been considered probably the leafy green part of the marijuana. But if, for example, if we have an ounce of marijuana passed between somebody over 21 and under 21, it could be less than an ounce, and it's a certain infraction. More than an ounce is another infraction. But let's just say it's two-thirds of an ounce of hash oil. It's very different than an ounce, a quarter or a half an ounce of marijuana. And in my view, as we look down these penalties or trying to keep people accountable, I really struggle with how we get there. So when we start saying notwithstanding any other law, I think we're opening up a huge problem for this definition to just trump everything we have in statute. We might as well just put the definition in and just leave it at that, because if I need some help on finding out that value statement.
I understand the concern, and I'm not sure that we could undoubtedly come up with a number of scenarios that would be undesirable, with regard to trading marijuana between adults and underage and so forth. I'm not sure at this time how I don't think I could offer a suggestion that would absolutely address that problem.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll still, and I understand, Bruce, and I would only ask you to help us consider that through this as this moves through the various different committees. But that's going to be one of the reasons why on this notwithstanding any other law, until I get some comfort on that, I just can't say, it's a blanket term that this will always trump until we get some definition on it. So, and Madam Chair, that's just my one of the things I'm worried about.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, if I may, sir, we're committed to public safety and welfare, and if there's any other suggestions that I can offer through that concern, we will ask for the bring us forward.
And on Friday, I'm going to hope to bring in an amendment that will do that, and so I'll try to get a copy to you as soon as I can, Bruce, but I'll try to get something to the committee as well. I think I have a way to describe it with some fairness of value that really tries to answer the initiative and its general move, but it is a specific amendment to the definition. So anyway, we'll keep posted on that.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. Okay, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Bruce, I think it's a fair point for us to discuss how you define an ounce. I think, and maybe this isn't an issue in other states, but it seems to me that you can have a plant that weighs several pounds, and you, at what point is it a dry ounce? Is it a wet ounce? Is it leaves falling off? The police come into your house and there's a bunch of dead leaves on the ground. at what point does it become an ounce as opposed to part of the plant?
To the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, thank you for that. I guess it's easier to answer in a retail environment where, of course, the product would have been dried and cured. There's a specific point in which you say, okay, that is now a saleable product. But a plant will definitely, a flower on a plant is going to be heavier than the final, that same flower ready for retail sales, simply because it has a great deal more moisture in it. So that is a fact. Most plants, but depending on the strain, and the manner in which it's groomed and so forth, most plants are only going to yield somewhere in the range of 2 to 6 ounces of flower and leaf. It would be, I've honestly never heard of a single plant yielding anything close to a pound. That said, this initiative would allow someone to have, up to 3 mature plants, and that I could easily see those yielding, 6 to 18 ounces between the 3 plants of flower. So that's the real thing. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I was just trying to clarify the weight of the material in an individual plant.
Yeah.
Well, I can guarantee you that there, in the next year or two, there's going to be a situation where the police go into someone's house, mm-hmm. and they've got the legal number of marijuana plants, but there's maybe a couple of flowers that have fallen off on the ground, and maybe they weigh a couple ounces. And that I'm just trying to create some kind of a record here for the courts to try to help understand what your intent was, what our intent was. And so, do you have any suggestions or any guidance for us?
Through Chair, Senator Wilkowski, My understanding of the testing initiatives is that an individual can have up to six plants, three of them mature, and the product produced from them. So I guess I would, being a reasonable person, I would have to acknowledge that that product could be, it could span a range as long as it's kept in the home, in that area where the individual has grown it for personal consumption. Beyond that, I'm not sure that I could offer any better definition.
And I'll just add something here, Bruce. I think we're just kind of having some sidebars. I think what just to give you a little bit of insight, what's happening is that you've got the committee bought into the idea of regulating marijuana and treating it like alcohol, and the recognition that it's a substance that Alaskans have been using. I mean, you've got pretty much lifelong Alaskans that recognize that marijuana has been used and been fundamentally legal by the Constitution our whole lives. And so now we're going to regulate it and bring it out of the dark, if you will. But at the same time, Senator Coghill and I were just sitting here talking. What's different and good about alcohol is that you have a proofing system, and you have a way of disseminating, distributing it that we can all understand from a public safety point of view that keeps us safe. So you can say one glass of wine, one glass of beer, one shot of hard alcohol, and we sort of understand in social circles, if you've had two glasses of wine, that's pretty good, that we're good. And so what we don't know here in our committee is, what does 1 ounce of marijuana mean? Is that two glasses of wine? I don't know. I don't have a clue. And that's what we're kind of talking about. And is 1 ounce of marijuana in a dried state two glasses of wine, but 1 ounce of marijuana in a liquid state, five glasses of wine? I don't know. And so what we're trying to say here is, okay, we get it. The public has voted for this. We don't want to discriminate. We see that there are some humans who do better consuming the mind-altering substance of marijuana than alcohol. So there's that. So for that reason, or for the reason that it's your privacy right, we're going to say, and for the reason that our jails are filled with people who've been arrested for using marijuana and haven't really done a whole lot wrong other than that. Let's say 1 ounce of marijuana, you can buy and sell it so long as it's licensed and you're an adult. But we still want to say, not in gigantic amounts and not where it's a threat to public safety. So we're kind of asking you to help us here, because you're the experts, we're not. We don't know where that threshold is, where it would be the equivalent of you walking around with a case of booze, basically, if I can give you the equivalent. But we don't know how to say that. So is 1 ounce of liquid marijuana, is it a case of booze? And it's ridiculous. And you're just sort of like waiting for trouble. Can you help us narrow it down definitionally or in some other way so that we're not making a law that really is not good for the public safety? And I think it goes to what Senator Wilkowski is saying, whether it's the plant size, and what Senator Coghill is saying, that, yeah, okay, it's true the initiative said 1 ounce, but let's be fair here, that if 1 ounce in a liquid form really is not the same at all as 1 ounce in a dried form, let's be reasonable. So can you help us on those things?
Thank you, Beth. I will make every attempt to answer this, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to fail to answer somebody's question. I think I may have misunderstood Senator Wilkowski's question right from the start. In discussions with folks in the industry, I've heard folks folks characterize it in this way, you know, they may at home have a couple of six packs of their favorite beer, a bottle or two of hard alcohol, and several bottles of wine. I have several of those, you know, myself, and they sit and gather dust for months or years.
Yeah.
Just, you know, waiting for the occasion when, you know, some friends might come over and I say, hey, let's try this wine I've been saving. I've heard people characterize their consumption of marijuana in largely that same manner. They might have some flour, you know, a quarter ounce of flour, a couple of grams of hash, a gram or two of hash oil, depending on, you know, their mood or the situation. I would agree, obviously, that, you know, concentrates are by definition more concentrated than the flour. The difference there, though, is in the consumption, where someone might consume an eighth of an ounce of flour in an evening, you know, perhaps amongst friends, they wouldn't consume that same quantity of hash or of hash oil. So I understand the concern. I don't think the potential for public the risk to public health or the individual, I don't think that potential is as high as it would be, for example, with alcohol, where, you know, clearly if someone took an entire liter and a half of, you know, chewed a liquor and drank it, really bad things would happen to them. Whereas if someone were to consume, you know, more than the average quantity of marijuana, they might regret it and they might not feel very well, but they're not going to die from it.
Okay.
So there are some subtle differences, you know, physiologically. Actually, not subtle, but fairly significant differences. And as I said at the outset, I apologize if I didn't really answer your question, because it's a tough one, and I think there's many parts to it. I guess all I guess I'm just reiterating. I think it we'd be better. The public would be better served by trying to address it at the retail side than applying some different degree of criminality to possession.
Sure.
Okay. Senator Clarkhill?
I may even agree with you, and I'll have to think about it, but at the same time, the initiative gave us the definition of an ounce, and we're now having to say a possession of an ounce is could be as low as just a ticket. And so at this point, if it's three-quarters of an ounce, you know, of hash oil, it'd be probably very similar to your liter of 100 proof. And so it could do some serious damage, whereas an ounce of leafy material may very well be, three-quarters of an ounce of leafy material may very well be just an infraction. So that's what we're trying to figure through.
Senator Wojcicki.
Thank you. And your staff just handed me a note. There's a case in Alaska, it looks like Voy versus State, which they talk about, quote, usable marijuana.
Okay.
And so I just tried to look that up. I couldn't find anything real quick. But this was a case that came out of, there was another case in Oregon back in 2012, I guess, where this exact situation came about. They went into someone's house. They had a certain number of plants. But then they had a bunch of the leaves drying somewhere else. And so it was a pound and a half drying. And what the attorney, and I don't know what the final disposition of the case was, but under Oregon law, they actually define usable marijuana. And we may want to do that. I guess that's up for committee discussion. But they define it as dried leaves and flowers of the plant, cannabis family, mora, K, and any mixture or preparation thereof that are appropriate for medical use. This is under the medical marijuana use. Then it says usable marijuana does not include the seeds, stalks, and roots of the plant. And then in this case, what they found was the marijuana, you're allowed to have a certain number of plants. The leaves that were drying were not considered plants, and because they hadn't dried yet, they weren't considered usable marijuana.
Okay.
So maybe some guidance for us, or at least what another state's doing on this, Madam Chair.
Okay. Excellent. Bruce, did you want to say anything more on that?
Madam Chair, I don't know if this is hugely pertinent, but as Senator Conkill was speaking, a thought came to me. My own personal experience that dates back a number of decades, actually, was such that, you know, when I thought of marijuana, it was largely the leaf and the flowers. But the product and the manner of consumption has evolved tremendously over the years. And this was a bit of an epiphany for me, too. And so it occurs to me that I think a lot of voters who did vote for this, they weren't thinking about the leaf and flower. And I can't speak to what they thought, obviously. I'm just, this is just conjecture. The market is such that most people look at this product as a concentrate, as hash or hash well. And I think a lot of people view it that way. You know, they were looking at, you know, God, I can have an ounce of hash or an ounce of hash oil. If I may just address something that Senator Murkowski mentioned, I think he mentioned this. I would agree that an ounce of concentrate, let's say hash oil, you know, it's obviously a concentrated form. It is obviously concentrated by definition. I disagree that it is out of hand hazardous. You know, I've heard of horrific things happening when somebody drank too much Cardi 151, you know, 151 proof rum. But that you don't typically hear the same kinds of really serious health impacts from somebody over consuming hash oil that they probably just go to sleep in short order or you know, get ill. I mean, if they try to drink it, which would be just an awful thing to drink anyway. I'm not sure that really answers anybody's question, but I was just reflecting on the perception of this bill that I think it depends a lot on one's prior experience, my own being an example there.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Okay, let's go to Hillary Martin.
This is Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal Services, and just specifically on the issue of notwithstanding the provision of law. Generally, just as a drafting technique, it's something that we try to avoid. It's not something we would necessarily recommend be placed in the bill. I think it just introduces uncertainty into what is meant by the phrase, what you're supposed to be notwithstanding, what is not now applicable. You know, I think it just, if there's something you specifically want to cancel out, it's better just to say that, you know, notwithstanding AS, whatever, notwithstanding C of this section, we've done that various times in the statutes. And that, you know, if you're leaving something that's unclear, you're just eventually leaving it to a court to decide what exactly it was you meant.
Senator Coghill.
Thanks, Hillary. Just from my perspective, and maybe you could say that it's a reasonable or unreasonable one, but you know, the initiative is a new section of law, and so there was an anticipation that there would be areas where it was controlled substance, like we ran into when we first tried to draft this. And then we went through the statutes to look for places where we could align it with the alcohol statutes, which was the intention of the initiative. But the fact is, the actual language of the initiative made it a narrow category without touching these others, so the notwithstanding seems reasonable at that point. But as soon as you start saying we're going to go reach through all the other statutes and put this definition in, then the notwithstanding language really becomes both confusing and less valuable. Is that a reasonable way to look at it?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, that is one possible reason. I think when you had an initiative that didn't directly deal with criminal law at all, and so you had the issue of there's existing criminal laws that criminalize marijuana, and now we're saying that certain types of possession and use are allowable, it was a way to make sure that those criminal laws didn't apply. Well, the draft now, you know, we've taken care of those criminal aspects, and there are new crimes, and it's a little, I think it can lead to confusion that, well, we have these crimes, what are we still notwithstanding? There's also potentially the possibility where you go through and look at the various laws and have said, well, no, we don't want to add marijuana here for whatever reason, and then you're potentially, that choice could potentially be canceled too, not just where you're adding it, but where you're maybe not adding it. So just from a purely drafting standpoint, it's just unclear, and as a drafter, we prefer things to be as clear as possible to make sure that the legislature's intent is clear in what is going, what appears in the bill.
Okay. Any questions for Hillary Martin? Yes, Senator Costello.
Thank you. And Ms. Martin, the memo that was provided by Mr. Pickett, he mentions that the Alaska Supreme Court has also ruled that the meaning of the phrase can be limited by context, common sense, and legislative history. And then he goes on to say that the phrase will be construed according to the principles of statutory construction set forth by the Alaska Supreme Court. And then further, you know, under the con section, he basically admits that in some cases that the phrase is superfluous, and that might be one of the reasons people don't want to use it. And I'm curious if this discussion, we are trying to micromanage the courts, and if they have the ability to apply common sense to an issue, look at the context. They'll have these hearings and the hearings, you know, that came about through the initiative process. I'm just curious if maybe somebody from the courts could weigh in on, you know, whether or not the courts have some flexibility that we don't think that they have in applying this term notwithstanding, which means in spite of or despite. And I think one of the reasons why we all have so much trouble with it and it's confusing is because it's not a word that we use other than in the statutes, in the law.
And I don't think that's really something you can weigh in on. Yeah, that'd be a tough one because that's kind of a case by case, so we'd have to bring in, you know, justices.
Well, I mean, if Nancy's here, I was curious, perhaps.
Doug is here, but, I mean, I could put you on the record, but you're just, I know it. Yeah, let's bring Doug.
Good afternoon. Happy to see you again here. For the record, my name is Doug Wilber. I'm Deputy Director of the Alaska Court System. I guess I don't want to speculate on how the court would interpret these particular statutes. I think that the attorney who spoke first, who has the memo that you were referring to, is it Mr. Pickett, I mean, he points out that a general rule of statutory construction for any court is to try to reconcile statutes rather than read them in such a way as creating a conflict. So that's all I can say about that, really. Just in general, the court will try not to find a conflict if a reasonable reading of the two different statutes exists so that they're not actually in conflict. That's a general rule. I agree with Mr. Pickett on that, and that's how our court interprets statutes as well. I don't know if that helps you or not.
Anything else?
No, thanks.
Okay, anything further on this subject? All right, let's go to amendment number one. Senator Coggo, and actually, Doug, if you want to just stay here. This is offering testimony on kind of what the options are available to us on delinquent minors and what we could do, what the court currently does do with respect to court view and those kinds of things.
And yes. Maybe I could
Senator
explain.
My
in the draft we have that it could be they could be withheld from the court view, and under this the action of a traffic violation, sort of. And under the rules right now, if there's a traffic violation or a fishing violation, something like that, a minor would still appear on the court view under the conditions. My amendment is going to say, I think if it's a violation, it should be treated just like the hunting, the fishing, the alcohol issues that are citations. And part of my testimony on that is going to be, I think that there's an accountability issue there, and then of course there's kind of an equal justice thing that I kind of was looking at. So,
okay. Again, Doug Wilber, Deputy Director of the Court System, Madam Chair, members of the committee. You know, this is a decision for you all to make. It's that we can work either way. But you're right. Currently, violations, even when committed by minors, show up on court view. They're treated under the statutes just like any other offense, in DUIs as well. But generally, most of these are violations, minor offenses. You get a traffic ticket. My daughter got her first speeding ticket several weeks ago. She'll be on court view. She may be already there. Those types of things, minor consuming, shows up on court view until it gets to the criminal stage, at least for people under 18. If under the current version of the bill, it's confidential, which means it isn't handled by the Division of Juvenile Justice, but it would look more like that kind of case. It would come in, court view would recognize the date of birth. It would not show up on court view. If the minor were to contest the violation, it would be in a closed hearing, just like a delinquency hearing would be, and not open to the public. We can do either way, but that's how it would work.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Wolver? All right, so next we have Tracy Wallenberg. She's online, and she's going to give us the Public Defender Agency's perspective. Tracy, are you there?
I am.
So tell us how you guys feel.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Tracy Wallenberg. Again, for the record, I'm the Deputy Public Defender for the Appellate Division at the Public Defender Agency. I think I testified to this at the last hearing.
Yes.
I think that the key is really keeping these records confidential. There were several concerns expressed at the last hearing that I think are really hold true, which is by not keeping these records confidential, they potentially have a barrier effect for minors continuing well beyond the time that they're 18. If they're not kept confidential on court view, anybody can access them, potential employers in the future being the main one that comes to mind. But it really could have, you know, an effect on minors well beyond, I think, what is necessarily commensurate with the behavior that is seeking to be punished. You know, the violation itself is not insignificant. I mean, if a person under 18 gets a fine of, you know, is stopped by a police officer or confronted by a police officer and given a ticket in the amount of $300, that's a sizable amount of money. I would suspect for somebody, for anyone, definitely someone under 18, who might not have that money and might have to ask their parents for that money, and may face some repercussions that way. So I think the main point that I wanted to make for the Public Defender Agency is the importance of keeping the records confidential and emphasizing that won't necessarily undermine the sort of immediate effect that a violation will have, and the violation will be immediate. It will be able to get the minor's attention in doing so, but won't affect the minor kind of indefinitely by making the record accessible on court view.
Senator Cargo.
So at this point, minor consuming can show up on court view. Have you seen those kind of detrimental effects that you're talking about under minor consuming?
Well, I know Senator Krakow, through the chair, thank you for that question. Several years ago, the minor consuming alcohol statutes were amended. There used to be, as I recall, a period of probation that lasted until someone was 21. That was amended, I can't remember exactly what year, but a few years ago, to require 1 year of probation. And one of the reasons behind that, as I recall, was that the fact that there was a probationary period was impacting the ability to get eligibility for the military. There were concerns, you know, anytime you're on probation, I think that's something that the military takes a look at, or at least that's my recollection. And so I think there are consequences of having, now that clearly was a consequence of having a probationary period, but I think there's consequences from having the records accessible that perhaps are not, that we can't fully anticipate, as that wasn't fully anticipated at the time that original NCA statute was passed.
Madam Chair, would you feel the same way about traffic violations, that they should be confidential?
Through the chair, Senator Cotto, I mean, I think, you know, serious violations, you know, for better or worse, in our current society sort of don't carry the same potential stigma that a marijuana violation might carry. I mean, it is true that marijuana use is still illegal under federal law. Criminal, you know, it's still criminal conduct under federal law in a way that a traffic violation isn't. And, you know, it's still illegal in most states under state law. And it carries penalties, you know, more significant than a traffic offense. So some minor, you know, picked up a marijuana violation here, it could have effects for that minor outside the state when they're seeking employment or other avenues in their lives as college students. And it may, people may have or harbor a bias, I think, against, you know, somebody who has gotten a violation for marijuana use at some point in their life in a way that they might not harbor a bias towards someone who's picked up a speeding ticket.
Madam Chair, I understand that. And so I will just contest that to some degree, and I'll have that conversation later.
Is there a requirement, Ms. Wallenberg, that their parents find out about, or their guardian find out about the violation?
Madam Chairwoman, there is, if you're charged in juvenile court, there is, yes, a requirement for, or encouragement for parental involvement. I believe the same is true in adult court. I'd have to re-familiarize myself with those statutes, and maybe Mr. Wallenberg can speak specifically to the statute. But yes, I think that there is provision for parental involvement.
Okay. Maybe we could have that.
I'd be happy to research that more specifically. I haven't looked at it recently.
That would be great by Friday. And the other question I have for the two of you is, What provision could we add if there isn't one here? And it looks like Matt Davidson was going to testify from the Division of Juvenile Justice, but instead we're having Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law. So another one that I want answered by Friday is, what could we add to look at diversion and, you know, some kind of class in both the area of alcohol and marijuana? I guess my overarching concern, you know, it's kind of this absurdity that if you get charged with a higher crime, and this is what we've been debating in our office, if you get a misdemeanor, you have to appear before a judge. That, on the one hand, gets your attention. On the other hand, it could also get you a diversion, which makes you get some treatment. And you may be addicted already. You may be on your path towards addiction. And then on the other hand, it can get you out of court view. So I like those three things. If you get a violation, it avoids the things Ms. Wallenberg's talking about, which I like, because I'd hate to see somebody who's made a mistake as a young person, who may be addicted, whose parents may have been addicted, and who's a young person now be barriered out of life opportunities. I don't like that. And so I don't want to see it on court view and have their whole life, now they're going down this path. On the other hand, they're not appearing before a judge. We may not be getting their attention in a meaningful way. Their parents may not have to know. I don't know the answer to that yet. And they may not be getting treatment opportunities. So I kind of want to hear from Mr. Wolver and Casey, if you could talk with the juvenile folks, and from Ms. Wallenberg about that kind of triangle, if I can. Okay, and so thank you, Ms. Wallenberg. And with that, I do want to hear from Casey. I don't know if any of you have thoughts, but that just seems the most sensible to me, is if you can, you know, keep it out of the, this is me personally, keep it out of that permanent record so they're not scarred for life, get them treatment, get their attention.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Before you go, I understand about the stigma, and what we're trying to do is lower the stigma way down to the bottom, because that's what this whole bill is about. But at this point, I know we're going to have Department of Law, but is Matt Davidson not going to be able to testify?
Oh, you were here. Okay. I was slipped a note that said no.
All right.
So, okay.
Okay, good.
Okay.
So I'd like to have them both give some testimony, please.
I was slipped a note, so I didn't know if it meant unavailable or what. Okay, good. So we got them both. Thank you.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Criminal Division, Department of Law. The only thing I wanted to say about this amendment, and this is a very complicated policy call, and we're here to help you however we can, is that regardless of what happens with this amendment, the language starting on page 1, line 9 on, it is needed as long as the legislature continues to have provisions in the bill that have juveniles treated with charged with violations, because this is just a clarifying amendment and make sure that everyone knows that the violations for people under 18 do not fall under the jurisdiction of Division of Juvenile Justice.
Okay,
and that's just clarifying language. It's not substantive, really.
Okay, so the second half of the amendment. Do we all have a copy of the amendment, Senator Coghill?
I thought we passed it on. Yes. Since I haven't moved it.
Oh, it's in our packet.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
All right, so just to re-clarify then, your testimony from Department of Law is not to the merit of it being on court view or not, but that the second half of the amendment is needed to simply say that if we do change it to a violation, the Department of Juvenile Justice will no longer have jurisdiction.
That's correct.
Okay, got it. Now, Mr. Davidson.
Yes, hello, for the record, my name is Matt Davidson. I'm with the Division of Juvenile Justice.
Okay.
Again, I'm available to answer questions. If I heard your question just a few moments ago, and I might be able to answer part of that.
Okay.
It's a little bit complicated, so.
All right.
Specific question, I'd be happy.
All right. So my specific question is, if we change it to a violation, I've got a couple questions. The first is, will parents be notified if a child receives a violation, a minor receives a violation for marijuana? That's question number one.
Again, that'd be under the jurisdiction of the district court.
Okay.
How that's handled, that's outside the jurisdiction of Division of Juvenile Justice. But my understanding is it'll be basically a ticket.
Okay.
And that a juvenile, like anyone who receives a similar violation, can pay that ticket without parental notification, would be my assumption, and the court can correct me if I'm wrong about that. So
okay.
That's outside the DDJ's jurisdiction.
And Jim, maybe a clarification
okay.
on that?
Okay.
How does it work with juvenile consuming alcohol, underage consumption? We don't do a violation on that, do we?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill. Again, consuming alcohol is outside the jurisdiction of the Division of Juvenile Justice. It's on our list of 4712-030 that the amendment addresses, the second part of the amendment addresses.
Right.
So again, that's part of the district, as a district court offense, and they'd be better to speak to how parents are notified. All criminal offenses under the bill, MIM 1 and MIM 2 would still remain with the Division of Juvenile Justice, and they would come into our confidential process, and parental notification is parental involvement is a big part of our process. If I might speak to the diversion portion of that, not every child who's referred for a criminal offense into the division sees a judge. They meet with a probation officer who then assesses their needs and risk based upon their risk of reoffending and what their needs are. If they've been referred to the division a number of times, they are more likely to be sit in front of a judge and potentially get adjudicated for those offenses. Those are the more major offenses.
So misdemeanors, basically. So it looks to me like if we want to do this, it would have to rise from this ticket, basically, to a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
And now how does that affect a juvenile's record? Is that something that follows them until they're 21 and then it goes away?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill. Yeah, I want to be clear, I wasn't advocating that change. If the legislature decided they wanted all juvenile possessions and offenses involving marijuana to be misdemeanors or above, the division would handle them the same way they do currently. I will note that that kind of change would be very problematic. It would create a whole new class of status offenses where you have to treat, you can't, let me see this correctly, federal law mandates that if you, you cannot make a crime, charge a juvenile with a crime that's not a crime if you're an adult. So therefore, you can't hold them, you can't securely hold them, they have serious rules about that. So that would be a, that would be an issue for the division. It, I mean, it's not insurmountable, but generally, like you noted, the intent of the initiative and the point of this bill is to minimize those offenses, and so making them, making an offense for a 17-year-old or making a criminal offense a crime, whereas it wouldn't be a crime if you're 18, is problematic.
Wow.
That's just all I wanted to know, that because and of course I still think the accountability is high, but I agree there's a stigma that will go with this because nationally marijuana still is going to be a controlled substance, even though we're working really hard to turn it into a regulated substance. So, and that's a dilemma we find ourselves in, is how to encourage youngsters to not do it by holding them accountable. And this is the first occasion they're going to be held accountable, and that's minor consuming this. And if it becomes a court view issue, then my question is, does that become a bigger barrier for them to proceed, or is it just a slap on the hand with some stigma that later on catches up with them down the road? So I probably lean towards the part that says hold them accountable first. And if they have to be on court view, maybe that's enough barrier for them to continue on in that kind of behavior. So that's been my focus at this point. And so, but I agree with the public defender that the stigma is going to be there nationally if you go from here to the military, for example. You know, I'm kind of caught between my want to hold them accountable and keep them from proceeding. To that barrier. So that's the dilemma I find myself in.
Wow.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I might, I know that, I'm not an expert on Title IV, which is the alcohol provisions and the proposed amendments. I know that they had, in the draft proposal, they have some proposal about confidentiality that might be applicable, might fit in with marijuana. I think I understood it as a temporarily it's on the, in the public record, but then once the case was closed, they paid the fine and they met the judge and did their treatment, then it would, then potentially it would be removed from court view and therefore it wouldn't be a lasting.
Yeah, I think Nancy Mead said that from the court system. There could be a way that we could have it once it's a live case, then it would be on court view until it was concluded.
That's a
and then it would be removed from the court view, and that might be the best way to go forward. But I still think. That may really be the answer we have to lean to.
Yeah.
So,
and then just another note. This is outside of the division, but there's several testimony about barrier crimes, and that there is a specific list of barrier crimes that the division of the Department of Public Health and Social Services maintains.
Okay.
And those are for specific positions. Now, again, the general idea that of a stigma is outside of that. Uh-huh. I mean, a marijuana ticket, I think, is unlikely to be a quote-unquote barrier crime for most jobs. That's not under this provision, it would be a violation, like a traffic ticket, rather than a criminal offense that would be in your criminal record. It's a subtle distinction, but, you know, again, the Division of Juvenile Justice handles criminal offenses only, crimes that would be crimes if you're an adult.
Yep.
And a violation for a marijuana ticket would not rise to that level and is unlikely. I'd be happy to get that information to the committee, but I don't think marijuana possession, the low-level possession currently, is considered a barrier crime for the types of jobs that we keep a record on.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Any further questions for Mr. Davidson?
I do.
Yes, okay.
Thank you.
Senator,
as we learned, and we know that there's a Title IV rewrite that's in the process, and unfortunately sometimes these legislative matters aren't like tires on a car where they're moving forward at the same pace, but it would seem that it would be in our interest to know what those recommendations are so that we don't have we don't pass this and then on the heels of it have a complete different way of approaching minors regarding alcohol. And so I think that might be something that we just want to keep in our minds. And I know Senator Machicki had mentioned that at a previous meeting also.
Yeah, excellent. We'll find that out from Nancy. Do you think we can get that from Nancy?
The
proposal. Well, the proposal.
Somebody has
the... Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just to clarify, Senator Machicki said he was working with the Department of Law on some of those things, but I think the Alcohol Control Board has been one of the advisors to that.
Okay. And on the minor part specifically, right?
So we might be able to get some comfort, but I understood they were heading towards a violation as well. Then it's just a matter of how do we deal with a minor consuming. Do we keep them in the court view, yay or nay? And that... And I still lean towards holding them accountable because I think the way the nation is viewing marijuana and alcohol both, that early accountability to me is very important. It's probably the reason to have a diversionary program somewhere along the line. But I'm going to keep an open mind on it, but I'm heading in that direction, probably stay there.
Okay, but you was mentioned there was a compromise. Maybe it was in court view until they met their payment or something. So we'll find out what it is. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's important to hold the kids accountable when they make mistakes, but what you're doing by keeping it on court view for the rest of their lives is you're holding them accountable for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
And it's so much more than a slap on the wrist. It's going to follow them for the rest of their life. And I just think kids make mistakes. And I think it's a bad policy call for us to keep this on these kids out in the public for the rest of their lives. I just think that's a bad policy call.
Okay, well, let's get that compromise language and see if there's a middle ground. Thank you, guys. I think we have time just to start the fiscal impacts, and let's have Jay Butler come forward for Senate Bill 30, the fiscal impacts. He's our doctor with the Division of Public Health, and he wants to tell us about the fiscal impacts.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer in the Department of Health and Social Services. Chairman McGuire, as I recall my sophomore public speaking training, I was instructed to never start with an apology, but if you could start with an appreciation, I will do that. Thank you for your wonderful overview of the agenda for the afternoon. I have to confess and apologize for a miscommunication because I was quite surprised to learn that I had asked to come to speak on the fiscal impact. So, I'm very sorry about that. I was asked to come to address any medical questions. I'm accompanied by department staff from behavioral health and obviously already juvenile justice to assist me. I don't know if either of my colleagues would like to address the fiscal issues or not.
Perfect. So that is the only reason that we have you here.
And Madam Chair, I'll just ask you one question before
Senator
we
Senator Coghill.
We're trying to figure out the definition of an ounce of marijuana and the health impacts, and as you can see, we're struggling around trying to figure out how to address it because under the various different penalties, we're referencing marijuana, and the definition has embedded in it a huge range of issues. And so I'm going to attempt to describe that somewhere along the line here, probably Friday. I'm going to come in with an amendment that has some correlation. I would encourage you to get in touch with my office to help me think through the various different ways that we might describe the scope within some huge concentrate values that don't relate to marijuana, because I just totally disagree with the one testifier that said when voters voted they were thinking of concentrates, and I just don't believe that. I think they were thinking about marijuana in a baggie, and then in that case we really we have to find an answer to it. So I'd just enlist you as part of that conversation.
Yes, Senator Coghill, through the chair, I'd be happy to talk with you further.
Thank you, Dr. Butler. Okay, and so I will ask. And I guess is this going, Amy, to the fiscal? Is that why you have them here? Okay, so who can speak to that? Diane? Okay. Diane and, yeah, so just Diane, I guess. Okay. I guess no other agency came back with fiscal note, but you guys, so we just want you on the record about why, what the costs are so that as it moves on to the next committee.
Okay. For the record, okay. My name is Diane Castell. I'm the prevention manager for the Division of Behavioral Health. Okay. I'm also the chair of the Title IV Rewrite Underage Drinking.
Oh, look at this.
So can you explain that?
Okay, good.
That as well.
Look at that.
Although I didn't bring that stack of information,
yes.
So I'll have to
go. The wheelbarrow.
You got it.
Yeah.
So, in response to some of the questions you're talking about, this was a huge piece of the work we were doing on the Title IV rewrite. And hopefully you have all seen the report that we did put together that outlines all the different recommended changes that we are looking at. It came out from the ABC board. It was a large group of stakeholders and steering committee members that worked on this for almost 3 years. I mean, just rewriting, you know, a statute that was already in existence. So, with that said, the Underage Drinking Committee did labor over the very questions that you are addressing and talking about, because we, like you, I mean, I'm a parent, I'm a grandparent, and I have children that I don't want them to be limited in their future. But at the same time, we also know that there are opportunities and opportune times that you make an impression on youth and get their attention for the behavior that they have engaged in. And we know, both with alcohol and marijuana, that even though it's illegal for both of those, or for underage youth to drink or to use marijuana, they still get access to it, and they still use it. We also know that, in fact, research shows, this is not for Alaska, but for nationwide, that those who begin using marijuana before the age of 25, their probability of dependence is significantly increased, and that nationally, 97% of new users are 24 years or younger. Mm. That's for marijuana. So those are things we need to think about in terms of making sure we keep marijuana, as well as alcohol, out of the hands of young people, that they don't start young, and that if they do start young, that we intervene quickly. Now, with that said, this was our huge dilemma on the Underage Drinking Subcommittee, is that we wanted there to be swift action, we wanted there to be consequences that were appropriate, not overly punishing, but appropriate, swift, and that there was consistent follow-through. What we found in the current law, and if you remember at the last committee hearing, Cindy Franklin talked about this, and she can talk about it much better in legalese, so I'm going to give you the layperson's version, is that the way the current law is for minors consuming alcohol is that it is identified as a violation, but because of the consequences that were tied to that violation, it, in terms of case law, turned it into a misdemeanor. Because we said, this is a violation, you're going to get kind of a ticket, but you're required to go for screening, you're required to follow through on education, you're required to get treatment if that's determined, and you can lose your driver's license. With those consequences to the young person, it turned it into, again, my understanding by law, into more of a misdemeanor condition. So what our attempt was to move through our recommendations on the committee, was to move it back to a true violation, because what we also found out in talking with public safety, with you know, those who are enforcing the law, that because it was such a kind of an unproportionate penalty in some sense, that people were not writing tickets, yeah, because they had to go to court, they had to do this, they had to, that it was such a long-term process that we really were just not enforcing it. And it does cost money. I think we talked about, or you all talked about that at the last hearing, and it was brought up today, that going to court, closed hearings, confidentiality, all of those things make it sometimes less enforceable, or that people choose not to, we'll just write off, send them home. In fact, I was told by someone in Anchorage that, you know, we're at a point where we just don't have the person power and the resources, so we break up a party, and instead of writing tickets for everyone, we just scoot them home. So there's no consequence there, and if kids know that, obviously, that does, there's no deterrent. So what we tried to find was a balance of making it back to a true violation where there would be swift, consistent, and proportionate penalties. Okay. That they would get a ticket, there would be a $500 fine, if they and there was a required court appearance, so they did have to go to court. If they go to court, their parents, as I understand it, are required to show up. At least one parent is required to show up, so they can't get away from it. Now, if they just pay a fine, that doesn't happen. But the way we framed our language is that there would be a required court appearance.
Okay.
Now, the issue of court view was kind of the big sticking element. Oh, well, let me backtrack. Because before I go there. So with the $500 fine, what we couldn't do in order to keep it a true violation was require that they go to screening, education, or treatment. But because we really want them to,
yeah.
And if we get the parents there, we thought, how can we encourage, educate the parents about the needs for it, that kids drinking young leads to lifetime, perhaps dependency, addictions, those kind of things, get their attention, and that if they went to screening through an ASAP program, went to an alcohol drug information school, got the education or treatment if they needed it, that the fine could be reduced to $50.
There you go.
So there was a huge incentive. That's why we made the initial fine. Again, this is in the proposal. We made it $500 to make it a large enough fine that people go, whoa, we're going to go for the $50, and you're going to go get screened, and you're going to go to this educational program. Now, the court view issue was the one sticking point, that we still didn't want this to be on their permanent record for all the reasons that you have indicated. It's good. We want them to have consequences. We want to get their attention. We want them to get the early intervention that they need if they truly have an alcohol problem or a marijuana problem. So that was kind of our dilemma. And as Cindy pointed out, there is some discussions right now about how we might be able to either temporarily have them on court view until they've completed what the requirements are, and then it would go away, but there's been no final decision on that, is my understanding at this point.
And if you could just explain, Dan, really quickly, when you say it would temporarily go away, or it would temporarily be there and then go away, what is
well,
the idea?
Chairman McGuire, my understanding, again, I'm not a legal person, but or a law enforcement, but when a ticket is written, that it automatically will go into court view, like any ticket. And so then it would be there until they go through the court appearance, they go through, either pay their fine or go through the requirements of the reduced fine. And then once that's completed, then it would be removed. But again, that is a proposal, and I cannot say that's how it will be. But that was our biggest concern, is that we wanted swift, proportionate, and fair penalties, but we also wanted to make sure we don't impact youth down the road. But it's balancing, it goes back to what Senator Coghill was talking about. It's balancing that, not wanting to impact their future, which we don't. Kids do make mistakes. We probably have all made our own mistakes as youth. And at the same time, we also know that early drinking, early marijuana use can lead to more serious situations down the road, and we want to intervene as quickly as possible to make sure that they get the help they need, if indeed it wasn't just a one-time experiment with their first time of drinking alcohol or first time using marijuana. So that is really the balancing act that we have to look at and face. But then within that, there are certain things within the court system that kind of limit us. Again, before, when we had it as a violation but still had these other requirements, it seemed okay, but it really bumped it up to a misdemeanor. So we tried to do tried to manage it that way, and that wasn't working. So now we're just trying to figure out the best way. And I think once we really do get that, get a good compromise about that issue, I think the best way is to have the minor consuming laws consistent for marijuana and for alcohol.
I love it. Could you, would you be willing to bring us that, that draft language?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
That's
any other questions?
No, I think that's a good...
I think that is so smart. I love it when people come up with smart solutions. I just, it just, it makes my heart sing.
Well, it was a smart group of people we had that worked, again, hard every other week for an hour and a half for almost 3 years.
Thank you. It's really wonderful. Senator Costello.
Thank you. And if it would be possible to get the list of the people who sat on that committee.
Absolutely.
Just as a backup and... for us to know who those folks are. Thank you.
Yes.
Great. Okay.
Did you, Senator McGuire, want me to touch on costs?
Yes, that would be great. And I know everyone here's got to go, so I will listen to it just to get it on the record.
I will just say it very quickly.
Okay.
Is that, you know, we have been debating the issue of a fiscal note. And when you look at this bill as it's drafted, you know, you read this through, there really isn't a true fiscal note here. Because the fiscal note for our division is really going to be based on consumption patterns and consequences.
Right.
When we look at public safety and public health issues. And for the work that we do, you know, we do primary prevention, and which is something we are already starting to look at how we can do a better job of developing materials about preventing. I believe, Senator Costello, you brought up the idea of educating people about the initiative.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent idea. We need to be doing that. We need to be getting out in front of this and giving parents, giving youth, giving adults, giving everyone better information. So those are things that are going to have some cost. They're not really tied to this bill. And then there's treatment issues. Well, right now we know that according to our treatment data, we have 580-90 people in treatment right now in Alaska for marijuana as their primary drug. We have much higher numbers for those who have marijuana as one of their issues in treatment. We also have data that shows that we have in Alaska about 9,000 people that currently meet the criteria for marijuana dependency and addiction. So what we are trying to do right now is to look at all the data we do have, put it together into a logical and sensical format so we can start making some analysis and some looking at trends of what we anticipate. But even talking with our colleagues in Colorado and Washington, they have been at this for such a short time, it's hard to know what kind of increases we will see. So we talk about a fiscal note in terms of we don't want to get caught not addressing the issues that there will be some additional costs, because
yeah.
we know that increased access, increased perception or a reduced perception of harm as it becomes legal, you will increase the usage, and there will be people that use it that have not used it before, that may overuse it, all the issues you've been talking about you know, the THC levels,
yes.
All of that is going to impact it. So that's what I would just say, is that we are struggling with how to approach this.
Fair enough. And, you know, and so in some agencies we'll put indeterminate, and this is a conversation really more appropriate for you to have with the Senate Finance Committee.
Yes.
And I encourage you to have it. One of the things I think we've failed to do in the area of alcohol and is a current discussion, local level, has really started it, and I appreciate it in Anchorage. In our town, vocally, in Senator Wilkowski, Senator Costello, in my town, is, you know, we take in quite a bit of tax from alcohol, and the notion behind that was we're going to use it to sort of treat the ill effects of alcohol as well, and we're not really doing that. We're kind of putting it into schools and roads and other things. Not that those aren't important issues, but we're also not putting it into treatment, and we're also not putting it into public safety and some of the other things that really do go into it. So I think having those conversations early on, getting them on the record, it really important, the fact that there will be costs associated with
treating those that become addicted to marijuana, those that are already mm-hmm. addicted, the education campaign about what you can do in Alaska that's legal and not, what you right. can't do, what the health effects are of marijuana, all of it, it's going to come to you guys. And so I appreciate you not being afraid and not tiptoeing around the subject. Fiscal notes are this weird area where they become sort of political. It's like, don't put a fiscal note on my bill, you know, and then people sort of do, and they don't like your bill, and don't if they do, and you know, and that kind of stuff. So I just wanted to get it on the record that you do have concerns, and that when you get up to the Finance Committee, you really ought to, you know, put those discussion points on the record. Right. With that, we're going to be adjourned, and we will take it back up on Friday. We're going to move this bill out on Friday, okay? Come heck or high water. We're adjourned.